Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Clinton and Kristen Brink were hiking with their two daughters in Arkansas on what should have been a peaceful Saturday afternoon at Devil's Den State Park. It's a state park that is one of the most well-known in the state of Arkansas. It's a very, very, very popular hiking spot, especially in the middle of summer on a Saturday. Campers, hikers, backpackers, they're all there. They're all enjoying their time and what should be getaway from, you know, normal life, a peaceful place to be. Instead, their day ended in screams, blood, and an order from their mother that saved their lives. Run as fast and as far as you can. And they heed that warning. They ran as fast and far as they could. And according to the 911 dispatcher that we interviewed exclusively here on the Hidden Killers podcast, they ran until they could no longer hear their mother's screams. That's the exact quote. In this episode, we're going to ask what happens to the children who survive something like this. What does trauma look like when you've just escaped the unimaginable? Here to help us unpack all that, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of many books. This one here, The Minds of Mass Killers, available wherever books are sold. Siobhan, let's dive into this. I mean, what immediate psychological responses do you expect from children who witness the violent deaths of their parents and run literally till they don't hear their mother's screams anymore?
Yeah, there's nothing more complicated when it comes to grief and trauma than a case like this with kids in particular. And their lives are never going to be the same. You know, we want to try to give them as much supportive therapy as we can possibly give, but they're changed. They're different. And that doesn't mean that they're ruined or they're not going to have good lives themselves, but their lives are going to be very different. It's a different trajectory than what it would have been.
I mean, what they witnessed is shocking, heartbreaking. I mean, it is the stuff straight out of nightmares. What we learned, I mean, exclusively here, way talking with the 911 dispatcher was, and this is the account that the children gave, as raw and real as it gets, They were out, you know, they've been hiking a lot. I looked at their Facebook page. It seems that they were really starting to enjoy the area. They had been here about 3 weeks. They'd moved from Montana to this area, another big hiking community. That's what people do here. It is hiking. We have the largest bike trail path in the nation that interconnects all of these cities from Prairie Grove to Bentonville to Rogers to Fayetteville. It's a big interconnected community, and people absolutely love it. People come here just for the hiking and the outdoor activities. And they were enjoying it. They have pictures of their family out, and this should have been just any other normal day. But what they witnessed was a man approach dad on this trail, stab him directly in the chest, allegedly, according to those kids. And then mom screams, "Why are you doing this?" And then yells at her kids to run as fast and far as they can, to which they did, and to which a good Samaritan on the path who was out having a normal day got the kids to the ranger station, which they called 911. The kids also said that they didn't identify the individual. They thought it was a stranger, according to them, at least to their knowledge of who mom and dad had any sort of interactions with. I mean, that sort of trauma right there. I mean, how do those memories imprint on a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old? And how... how does this sort of thing evolve over time?
You know, it's hard to say how it evolves. They would have a very visceral physical reaction to stress and trauma, and I think have a lot of physical symptoms. You often see kids with, you know, headaches and stomach aches and other physical complaints after something like this. The big thing is going to be their nightmares. I would bet that they're going to have a very hard time sleeping, and they will replay this kind of event in their dreams, and that may go on for most of their lives. There are things that therapists try to do to help them process things like play therapy, art therapy, EMDR. But really, we can't erase this. We just can't. And so that's the thing that's so tragic about it. It's like this kind of violence, it permeates and doesn't ever go away. And it doesn't just affect the people that are killed. It affects all their loved ones. And so they have a state of this biological hypervigilance where they just don't ever feel safe in the world for good reason. Mm-hmm. They'll always be waiting for a bad surprise.
And that's unfortunately going to haunt them forever. I'm not trying to find any sort of silver lining here because I don't think there is one. But compared to an adult on the trail, let's say there had been another adult with him. There was other people, another couple that we had talked to saw the killer and witnessed him come up to them, look them up and down, and kept on moving. Had, you know, in theory, let's say that they attacked a group of four adults. How would an adult, matured brain handle this trauma differently than that of the children? Is there any positive to the fact that they were younger when this took place versus an adult having this take place in front of them? Or is it more traumatic because they were children?
I think it's more traumatic when they're kids because they don't have the psychological resources to put it into context, to really understand how isolated this kind of event is. It's going to feel more bigger and global to them and really impact their sense of safety in the world. So they don't have a history of 25, 30, 45 years of moving through the world and feeling safe. You know, this has become their reality now at a very young age. And they also may be more prone to, as they grow older, survivor's guilt. Why did we survive? Was there something we could have done? Whereas an adult may be able to put that in a more realistic context and understand that, no, it was not their fault. There was nothing they could have done. But kids would have a harder time with that.
Without a doubt. I mean, just trying to process this, you know, as an adult is difficult as we try to put the pieces together. Why would this take place? Why did this happen to begin with? Left with just so many questions about all of that. I mean, if you were speaking directly to the guardians now, I believe they're with family from what we understand. Obviously, the first thing anyone is going to say, you get them into therapy. Of course, that would be a good thing. But beyond I mean, what, there's got to be specific. This has got to be something they're going to really have to look at more so, I would say, with a scalpel than just let's find a therapist online and hope for the best. What would you be advising them? Because this is quite a trauma. What are the next steps for this family and the people who are going to try and help these children heal?
It's going to be a long haul, a long road. Be prepared for an emotional roller coaster of a lot of intense feelings. Support them, comfort them, keep them safe, you know, from the environment. Keep the media tuned out so that they're not exposed to continually being re-traumatized with triggers from things that they see or hear about or watch. Comfort, whatever comforts them. And that's going to be tough. It's going to be challenging because I'm sure sometimes it will seem like nothing works. But just understand that it's going to take patience, time, and, you know, a lot of teaching them to soothe and calm their nervous systems down. So keeping a regular routine with bedtime, a lot of soothing activities at bedtime, and, you know, still as much as possible encouraging them to find pleasant moments. You know, this is where I think animals, pets can be really soothing for kids and help them rediscover joy. But that may take a while. It's going to be rough for a time.
I know some of the family is watching this, so I know your words are going to mean a lot in terms of, you know, helping them find some direction because this is, I mean, I can't imagine being in that place. I mean, let's talk about, you know, the individuals who are now left out of nowhere. Suddenly they're in the custody of two young girls who just lost their parents. I mean, the trauma of that as well for a family member. What would you advise them to do for themselves so they can be there for those two little girls the best that they can after an unimaginable situation?
I think families really benefit from survivor groups. You know, there are often in, I don't know Arkansas very well or where the kids are at, but often there are groups for people who have lost loved ones in a violent crime or some kind of violence. And I think that's very helpful because you just need a place to talk about your feelings. And sometimes hearing the stories of other survivors, it just helps you know that you're normal and that these intense emotions, you do work through them over time and life does begin to feel better. But again, everybody's impacted differently. We've all got different resources and some people, you know, they may feel like they're going crazy for a while and that's normal. That's okay. And so I think just giving people a place to talk about their feelings and, you know, doing the practical things, avoiding nervous system stimulants. It's not a time for a lot of caffeine, a lot of alcohol. People try to self-medicate. That typically just makes it worse. So we encourage, again, eat healthy, try to get sleep. If you are finding that you really can't regulate your mood or you're having crying episodes and can't stop, panic attacks, talk with a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner, you know, because sometimes the medication, somebody can take something just, even if it's on a temporary basis that helps them sleep again. God knows I went through a trauma where I needed to do that and I'm grateful for it, you know. There are things that can be done medically to help people just start to regulate their nervous system again. And I think we have to try everything that's helpful.
And that's 1,000% true. I'm not trying to sell your book right now, but I'm going to sell your book right now. Nightbird, this is your memoir. You've gone through tremendous trauma and you write about your road to recovery and getting back to yourself in there. So I do suggest this definitely to be somewhat of a roadmap for people who are going through trauma and finding a path. But that's, I mean, you certainly come with the reps and the experience to say exactly what you just said. Let's talk about the suspect himself. As of our recording right now, not in custody, but even when they're in custody, we're still going to have the exact same questions. How do you interpret the suspect's actions here as they went into this. What we do know is that they had a license plate that was taped over. So the intent immediately is to not be recognizable. The vehicle still up for debate as to exactly what it was, although we have obtained exclusive video here that shows the suspect's vehicle being described possibly as a Mazda, Acura, possibly BMW, black four-door sedan. I've heard everything from a different type of Kia as well. It's still up there, but it's a black four-door sedan. The video is available on our website or on our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, if you want to take a closer look at that, or on social at Tony B Pod on X or Twitter. You got that. You got the guy who's also in 100-degree late July day in Northwest Arkansas, wearing gloves, fingerless gloves, as they've been described, black long sleeve shirt, black pants. We have the image as well. I should just put that up so you can see what this man was dressed like that day. This is his attire, and a very large vinyl backpack that the witnesses described to us as being extremely out of place. It's a little difficult to see all the dimensions of it right there, but extremely out of place. This was not, you know, let's go out for the day and hike backpack. And this isn't a trail where you're going to go backpack it for like weeks on end either. It's an afternoon hike. To go out there like this, obviously standing out in a crowd compared to everybody else who's out there in sports gear and, you know, trying to stay cool as they walk the trail. What is going on with a person who comes into a situation like this? Obviously prepared, it seems.
Yeah, he was there as a predator. And did he have this couple, this family as a specific target? Or was he looking for something that was symbolic to him? I think probably the latter. We know there's a story. He has a reason. The reason does not make sense to the rest of us, but the first thing that popped into my head watching, you know, the videos about the case and the people that were in the vicinity that ran into him is that this is a person likely who's got some paranoid delusions going and enacting this almost cosplay kind of fantasy where he dresses up like what he thinks this intimidating killer is going to look like. You know, the wearing the black clothes. A lot of the mass killers go out dressed up in black clothes. There's something symbolic about, you know, the bad guy, the really bad guy is dressed in black. So I think he had a script, a fantasy script that he was following. Also the choice of a knife rather than a gun. Why that? But that was my first thought. Rather than it being something personal, it's likely a person with a mental health history, some to some level psychotic thinking going on, and paranoia. He wasn't trying to disguise his face, but he certainly, you know, you would think a more rational killer, let's say somebody that was a professional hitman or something like that, would be trying to blend in with the crowd and certainly wouldn't go out in midday in a crowded area. So my sense is that this is a person with some kind of paranoid delusion that had a story. And was he looking for a happy family? Was he looking for a family with kids? What is the deeper meaning of that? At some point, if they catch him, we may hear that. We may know. It reminded me of a case many years ago, in fact, a couple decades ago, of a guy I worked with who had inexplicably gone out and shot a group of Mexican gardeners, killing one or two of them. I don't remember, but it made no sense. And he had this fairly benign history. He didn't have any history of, you know, being locked up for anything, no criminal history. But the story in his head, he was in his mid-20s at the time, he had started having paranoid delusions that Mexican gardeners were trying to put poison in the California aqueduct to poison the state of California. Completely delusional.
Yeah.
Completely paranoid. But then the angel Gabriel appeared to him and one day said, take your hunting rifle and go out and I'll show you who these specific gardeners are. And that's what he did. And the sad thing is, when he was on meds and he was no longer psychotic and delusional, he was a very nice guy. And he was not ever going to be free the rest of his life because he was not safe. But something akin to that is what this made me think of. This guy was on a mission and clearly was coaching cogent enough to tape over the license plate. But he was bizarre in the way he did it, the way he dressed, and the way he was, you know, sizing other people up and analyzing them. I'd say there were a lot of potential victims out there today. And who knows the story behind why these particular folks were picked.
It's a very interesting analysis. I was wondering, somewhere along the same lines, you've said it extremely eloquently, far better than I ever could. The witnesses that we talked to described it as a death stare, very bad energy off of this guy, which, you know, I mean, one could argue, well, that's energy, that's people. But I mean, they were picking up on those cues. This is a guy that was very, very out of place, and he did kind of size them up, it seemed. The question is, you know, was he sizing them up as if, could these be my potential targets, or right. is it, could these people outpower me? Is this one that if I went after them, it wouldn't work out so well for me? But then I was wondering about the symbolism of who he chose, because he chose another pack of four people, two of them children. I don't know if the thought was, I can overpower the kids too. They're not going to get away, but they clearly did, thank God. Or was that representative of something in his past? And that is kind of where my mind was going. Is this someone who had past family issues and is now, you know, lashing out essentially at the symbolism of what that represents, almost, I mean, in a different sort of way as like Brian Koberger did, you know, the symbolism of Mattie Mogan, of those happy young college kids that were living their lives in an unattainable reality in the mind of Brian Koberger for himself. So rather than trying to make fixes in their own life to fit in and to have that, it went to destroy. Mm-hmm. Is that something that may have been in the mindset of this individual?
Certainly could have been. And the choice of the knife also connotates a lot of rage, mm-hmm. a lot of anger. And a paranoid person with some kind of a fantasy script, some kind of a delusion that he's acting out, they're very scary people. And you do notice a look in their eyes mm-hmm. that's incredibly intimidating. And looking at the way they do eye contact, that's always a sign to me. If you see a person on the street with that kind of eye contact, it's like you need to cross the street mm-hmm. because it's a very bad sign and often indicative of psychosis. I have seen people, as horrid as it is, who actually took a knife, stabbed, and beheaded their mother. Several cases of that, in fact. And again, these were people that were incarcerated, you know, probably forever. And this is the kind of rage that's completely hard for the rest of us to understand, and especially when it doesn't make sense. But when they believe their mother was possessed by the devil and they were killing Satan, or and there was actually one case where the guy did that to both parents, and again, it's psychosis, which means the brain is very sick.
And that's what makes this very, very troubling, because a lot of people, the easy write-off on this is, oh, you know, he's crazy, he's tweaking out on meth or whatever. But this was a planned attack. I mean, a lot of times you see like meth addicts or drug addicts or something's going to out there and they're having their own delusions. They're not taping over the license plate. They're not right. coming in with right. the full tactical gear to carry out an attack. This is something premeditated. He was thinking about this for quite mm-hmm. some time. That doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. rule out that he's, you know, a psychopath by any means. Plenty mm-hmm. of psychopaths are able to do very tactical things. Mm-hmm. But it to me, does the fact that there does seem to be quite a bit of premeditation here, does that rule out the likelihood that this was just some drug addict that decided to tape over his license plate and kill somebody on the trail that day?
Yeah, I would say so. This wouldn't be your typical meth-fueled, you know, rampager or situation. This is somebody who had put time and thought, and just like we say with the Brian Koberger type people, had very likely been fantasizing about it for a while. Mm-hmm. And this is why when he's caught, his history, and if there were any similar violent events or threats or, you know, anything in the past, that would really be relevant.
the community right now, it's amazing when something like this happens because everybody thinks they know who it is. And I applaud everyone who has sent us information, sent us pictures, and please do keep sending us anything that you know and anything that you may think, because we're going to take a look at it. We'll pass it on to authorities if that need be, but we'll dig. We will dig, and people can do that. I want them to know that. You can go to our website, truecrimetodaypod.com. There's a contact section right there. That's True Crime Today Pod, or you can reach out directly through Facebook or any other social media. I'm watching it quite tightly right now as people come to us and give us information. That's how we've done most of this, has been individuals reaching out, the witnesses, the dispatcher, the guy who has the camera of the vehicle that we have exclusively shown here at the Hidden Killers podcast. So please do keep doing that. But what would this guy look like? I mean, not in terms of physical appearance, but let's say, you know, this is your neighbor. A lot of people are going, I think it's my neighbor. I think it's this guy. I think it's this person's ex. And I'm getting everything and anything right now. But what truly would someone like this possibly be like if they are your neighbor? Would there be any red flags to look out for if you're suspecting that, hey, maybe that guy could be the person?
My guess is this is a person who's rather isolated. And if he's your neighbor, he probably doesn't wave and say good morning. You know, this is a person who stays away from other people, probably not a happy family man, you know, who shows up at the soccer matches. I mean, this is probably a person who stays to himself. And he may come off as kind of odd. He may come off kind of creepy, but he may not. He may just be very, very private.
He walked through a very heavily populated trail full of families. The eyewitnesses that we talked to described it as a very busy day on the trail, despite it being 100 degrees. It doesn't stop people around here. They're used to it. They like to hike in the heat. And they described the trail as, like I said, heavily busy, and in a way where you look forward and you look behind you, and your odds of seeing someone ahead on the trail or behind you are pretty high. And that was basically most of the day. So to decide that you're going to do this on a trail where people are constantly flowing through it in a sick way, I mean, he lucked out. Nobody just walked up on this murder taking place in real time. They found the bodies just a few moments later. But that says something to me about this guy, the fact that he was taking that risk of being walked up upon, or did he care? I mean, what, or is that part of the delusional thinking that may be going on with someone like this?
My guess is, you know, if he sees himself as God's special agent or something, he may have been fairly convinced he was going to get away, which he has so far. But it's hard to read, you know, into that exactly what could have been happening. But again, a rational murderer, are there rational murderers?
Is that a word? That's a new one. The rational but murderer.
Well, we can say a person more grounded in reality, even if, let's say, he had a reason to target this family, which doesn't sound likely, but even if he did, he would not have done it in this way, in this place. You know, the goal would have been to do something where he wasn't going to be seen and discovered immediately. So that, again, is what made me think psychotic. There's something really off here.
And it also leads into the other question, because everyone's trying to dig and look and, okay, well, what's going on here? They moved here about 3 weeks ago to a small town of Prairie Grove. I actually used to live there. It's a little kind of bedroom community just outside of Fayetteville. I actually walked up and down the streets of it on Sunday, going to antique stores. Nice little town. It really is. And I talked to several of the shop owners, and I said, now, have you heard about this? Because that's where they lived, and it's very close to the park. No one even had any idea that day of what was going on, but that's because of the police messaging and not getting the information out fast enough. That's a whole other topic we're not going to get into right now. But the fact that this occurred in this kind of a setting, it makes you wonder what was going on. He had not started his job yet. The husband, the father, he was supposed to be working as a dairy delivery driver. I believe he transferred from a company in Montana to Northwest Arkansas. So there's not the work history here where maybe there's somebody mad or things of that nature. He wasn't even at the job yet. So the idea of an angry coworker or a targeted hit don't seem to make a lot of sense. And if it was a targeted hit, that would be one of the sloppiest hits we've ever seen.
Yeah.
But there are sloppy hits out there as well. But again, we don't know much about the family. They don't necessarily stand out to me as anything particularly where someone's going to order a hit on them. I don't know what the criteria honestly is for that, but it, I don't know. It just doesn't feel like that. Would you be ruling out things like that at this point psychologically when you're trying to zone in and hone in on who actually did this?
Yeah, that would be the worst hitman ever.
Yeah.
Completely counterintuitive. It wouldn't make a bit of sense. So yeah, I just go back to a guy who had a reason. He was very clear in his mind on what that reason was, but the rest of us would look at and say that is not rational. Doesn't make any sense.
Obviously, we don't know anything about the guy. But the way that this attack was carried out in this community that loves to hike and loves to go on these trails, and there's hundreds of them everywhere. With that going on, what do you think? Is this guy a threat still? Do you think he's looking to attack again? Is this something where, I mean, so far he got away with it. People are not going on trails at this moment in time in this area. At least a lot of people are not. You know, is this the beginning? Does this look to you like this could be the beginning of someone who's trying to be a mass killer? Or is this someone out living their horrible dark fantasy and now disappearing into the ether?
Could be either. My guess would be that he's having a sense of euphoria after fulfilling the fantasy. Mm-hmm. And so is there a chance that he could repeat it? Sure. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, don't have any information at this point to indicate either way, but it's certainly possible. It may be that this was the big thing and this would hold him over for a while. But would there be an urge to repeat? I would be concerned about that.
What's the likelihood that he returns to the area? I mean, the trails are closed off specifically at Devil's Den right now. There are other parts of the park that are open. But obviously, we see this quite often with killers returning to the scene. We saw Koberger driving back by the house just hours after the murders took place. Mm-hmm. Is this likely someone who, like I said, as of right now, he has not been found? If he has been by now, well, then there's that. But as of this moment, is this likely someone who's hiding in plain sight? Do you think this is someone who is hiding in the shadows again for fear that maybe law enforcement does know who they're looking for and just have not announced that as of yet? And they're trying to track this man down.
Yeah.
What do you think's going on in this person's mind at this moment?
Yeah, that was one of my thoughts, is that law enforcement may know a lot more than they're letting us in on at this point. I actually hope that that's the case, that they are onto some leads here by now. And so is he very likely could be monitoring the news very closely to see what's coming out and what people are saying about identifying him? Might he go back to the scene of the crime? They sure do tend to have a compulsion to do that. And that would, I think, go back to how rational is he? Because I think a rational person would get pretty far away from there, but he may not be. He may be lurking in the area.
There's a lot of witnesses who did see him. Several witnesses said they knew something was off. How does hindsight guilt show up psychologically in bystanders? You know, they knew something was off. You know, did they, or is that kind of one of those things that come up later on where it's like, well, looking back, but the folks I talked to, they all four of them said the next day when they found out the news about the park, they had passed hundreds of people that day, but the one that stood out to them was this guy.
Mm-hmm. I would trust that. And, you know, sometimes people will reflect, and it's very distressing to be the one that got away. It's like, why did we get away? And so that, again, that's this, you know, the grenade effect from violence, is that it impacts so many other people. People wonder, could I have done something to interrupt this? You know, they go over it and over it in their minds. And basically everybody in the area will feel a certain amount of trepidation, I would think, when they're out hiking or out in nature, because, as I use the term a lot, bad surprise, you know, and that's what trauma does. It's like this bad surprise, and people start to feel this anticipation of things like that. And we can't say that that's non-rational, you know, it makes perfect sense. So I would expect that anxiety in the general public there is going up, which is why I think it's so helpful for people to find other people to talk about these feelings. And, you know, then when he's caught, there's the collective sigh of relief. Everybody in the community can go, phew, you know. But does it affect the way people move through the world forever? Yeah, it does. You know, the cases that I've seen through work, it affects my sense of safety in the world. Places I'll go, places I don't go. And, you know, just you had mentioned something earlier that I think is very relevant, that predators often, when you get into the mind of a predator, how did you choose your victims? They'll say, I looked for the person that would be easy to hurt.
Yeah.
And we hear that over and over again. And so I think, again, being a woman in the world, and I'm a rather small woman, I have several friends that are 6 feet tall women, and I think they move through the world differently than I do, being a rather small woman. And I think these are all things that it's helpful for us to recognize and talk through. How do we feel safe?
And that's a big question. I mean, we're not trying to play a game of, you know, who had the most trauma here, because clearly those children win the award for that, the award nobody ever would want to get. But there is a thing as communal trauma, where a community feels it at the same time. And I would say that that's a big thing here right now, because this is a very family-oriented community. People come here because of the lifestyle, because it's very safe, because there are very good schools, because you can live in relative safety and not fear for your life. I'm certainly questioning some of my own rules of letting my child run around in the neighborhood. And an interesting thing in this area for me is I've been, you know, and I'm not to say a helicopter parent, but I have in time relaxed some of the anxiety of that with society. And in past years, I've let my daughter go out and play in the back, go in actually to the woods, which are in the back, to go play with a friend and play by the creek and play literally by one of these trails. And, you know, lovely times. It's childhood memories. It's fun stuff. It's things I remember looking back on and having some of the fondest memories of childhood, playing in the creek with friends and getting crayfish or crawfish.
Me too. And parents just let us out in the morning and come back at dark. And we were all over.
And I loved that for my daughter, because it's like she's getting a little taste of something that really doesn't exist. But in this community, it's felt very safe to do that. This kind of shatters that sense of safety. Should it shatter that sense of safety? Because we're just not in that world. And no matter how safe we feel in a community, maybe we're just not, and we shouldn't be able to, we just can't do those things anymore. I mean, how does a community deal with something like this? What is an overreaction to something like this? I mean, where it evolves from avoidance to paranoia?
That is such a hard thing to answer, such a hard thing to answer. And it's something that I think every parent has to sit with and talk through and think about on a case-by-case basis. I recently had a friend in Oakland, California, which is not known as a particularly safe place, who was letting his four-year-old go out and wander down the city street under this parenting philosophy of free-range parenting. Let the kids go and you know, we're too protective of them and all of that. The kid had a little, he put his name tag on him and the phone number, but it was like this exercise in, we're going to help him feel powerful in the world that he can go wander around outside. Well, the police brought him back. Somebody called CPS on him. And I have to say, I would have too, you know, I agreed with that. And his theory was, well, most kids are molested by family members. Okay, statistically, that's true. But it only takes one predator on the street with your cute little four-year-old to have a disaster happen. And so people will have very different feelings about it. And yes, I think there are people who overdo it in both directions, and probably finding some kind of middle ground is the best zone, but every community is different. And It's a hard one. I think definitely not letting kids go places alone increases the odds that they're going to be safe.
Yeah.
But yeah, as a little kid, you know, 5 years old, I was riding my little bike all over town and, and you know, but then did in middle school, did start having some bad incidents happen with older men. And so, it's a tough call for parents.
I mean, it really is. I mean, it does shatter probably somewhat of a false sense of safety, even when they do find the guy, which I feel like they will. There's a lot of information out there on this person. Even when they do find this person, that sense is still shattered for a lot of people, for a community. Do you get that back? Can you get that back? Do you want to get that back? Should you get that back? Or is this kind of a reality check of it's a dangerous place out there. Even here where things have been relatively safe, there's people out there that are willing to do whatever.
Yeah, there definitely are. And a lot of murders and bad things that happen to kids happen in rural areas. There are more mass shootings in rural areas than there are in urban areas, interestingly. So I lean on the side of caution, and I struggle with that same thing. I don't have grandkids. Sometimes I'm grateful I don't have grandkids because I would worry about them all the time if I did.
Sure.
And, you know, it's one of those difficult things with modern life is how do we move through the world feeling safe? And the other thing is there have always been a certain amount of bad things that happen. But now because of the media and the internet, we know about all of it when it happens. Yeah. And so that increases our sense of danger that, you know, there's really no safe place.
I mean, obviously this community where it happened in here, where I'm at, is feeling it. But now anybody who's watching this anywhere is going to be thinking about hiking and like, maybe we're going to go to IKEA this weekend instead of the hiking trail.
I was thinking about it. I was doing the same thing. We've got all kinds of hiking trails in Oregon, and you can be out far away and never run into another person. And it's like, I don't think I'd feel comfortable doing that right now.
No, I mean, honest to God, it was running through my mind that day, but then I looked at the temperature and said, yeah, no, we're going to go not do that. We're going to go in the pool instead. But there's one other piece of this that I wanted to pass by you and get your thoughts on. And that's the moment as to which the horrific incident took place where the man came up to the family and stabbed Clinton in the chest. Kristen, allegedly, according to the kids and our reporting here, said, "Why are you doing this?" I'm just going to leave it at that. Why are you doing this? What do you make out of that message and those words from Kristen to the attacker as it was happening and then urging her children to run fast and as far as you can? Mm-hmm. Notice she didn't run as fast and as far as she can with the kids. She stayed there. Why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. Does that tell you anything?
Mm-hmm. Well, it tells me that she did not know this person.
Okay.
And that... I mean, that would be the first thing that would pop into my head. Could I be wrong on that? Sure, I could be.
Sure.
But you know, you would think if this was someone that you had a stalker or a vendetta with them, that, you know, you would have had some inkling of why they were doing it. This is the guy that's been following us around or whatever. But the fact that she told the kids to run, good mom, protective, that was the best thing that she could have done. And she probably wanted to protect her husband. I mean, that would have been my inclination too. Can I fight? Can I do something physically? You know, even if that was completely not in reality, but that was probably her instinct at that point was to try to help.
I'm also going to guess on this one that it was run as far and fast as you can, because mom's going to stay back here and I'm going to distract this guy to make sure he doesn't go after you. Because if she didn't tell the kids to run, if she stayed there and got attacked too, then the kids would have been there. And God knows.
Yeah.
I mean, does this read to you like this guy was targeting just the parents and the kids just happened to get away? Or, you know, was it let's take out the parents and then do something with the kids?
Could have been either way.
Yeah.
Could have been either way. And when he's caught, and if he'll open up about what was this bizarre fantasy that he was enacting, it'll all make sense if he'll open up and talk about it.
So many questions. And just not a lot of answers. Siobhan, you helped us make a little bit more sense of it today. Her two books, and I highly recommend checking them out, Nightbird, your memoir, especially about dealing with trauma and getting through it. And of course, if we're looking back at the killers, you wrote kind of the book on it, The Minds of Mass Killers, both available wherever you get books. Siobhan, as always, thank you so much for being on and giving us your insight.
Thank you.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Big news! Wayfair's end of season sale is here. It's Wayfair's Labor Day clearance. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home at Wayfair. Plus amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals on home finds in every style. This is your last chance to score end of season savings, and it's happening now. Did we mention fast shipping on everything? Don't wait. Head to wayfair.com today to score up to 70% off now through September 2nd.
Wayfair, every style, every home.